do some portion of it. Some of the work would still be valid down the road, but this, I believe, is contingent on proceeding with the wings project. That is basically the description on that package.
Okay. Any questions, Senator Johnson?
Well, I apologize, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Henderson for missing the part of yesterday. And I presume you discussed the wings project.
No.
Oh,
no.
I haven't gotten to it yet.
We're coming. We're coming to that one.
Great.
We want to get and hear that before we get discussion on the whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, yes, sir.
Yeah, that's fine. let's move ahead to the next package if there's no question, and understanding we may be back discussing this in a moment.
The next package, Mr. Chair, is package number 306, which is on page 68 of your binder, but we can delete that package. It is the replacement of the Halon systems in two offices in the building, and we've made a determination that we can roll that in with the wings renovation project, or if the wings renovation project does not move forward, we would figure out how to fund that within the existing base budget for facility services. So you can delete package number 306. Now we come to the capital construction project that I know Senator Johnson is interested in, which is package number 302. This is the wings renovation project, and the total cost on this right now we project at $31,542,525. That is based on the latest estimates from the architect on what it would cost to proceed with the project. We do have a contractor on board right now who is studying the architect's plans and developing their own cost estimates, and they are scheduled to come back to us in June with a guaranteed maximum price on the project. This also includes that portion of the project itself is $28 million, a little over $28 million.
Mr. Chair, how was that contractor selected?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, the contractor was selected and put on a contract that is a CMGC contract, Construction Management General Contractor contract. It's the contractor who did both the hearing room renovation and the replacement of the electrical switch gear in the old portion of the building. The contractor was pre-qualified by DAS to perform CMGC projects for the executive branch. They have also done a number of projects for the Oregon University system on the college campuses.
Mr. Chair, I would just make the observation that there is probably great value in having a contractor familiar with an old building with some old systems. That's the good news. The bad news is that this is a very large contract, and we have sat in the same hearing room and heard a litany of complaints about the states, particularly with highway projects, not having the opportunity to refresh their bid lists. And I don't know whether or not there's going to be any opportunity for subs to be selected out of women, minority, emerging businesses. I can understand why you are sticking with somebody that knows this building, but a $30 million project, I'd sure like to see a plan for how the little guys are going to get a shot at some of the work here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, the contractor is required to follow all of the bid requirements for all of the subcontractors who will be working, which will include the women, minorities, and emerging small businesses.
I'm fine.
There's a great deal of detail on this project in Appendix F of your binder. If you would like to look at that, we can actually walk through those documents, and I can tell you briefly what each of those are. The first document is just a cover memo explaining what is included in that packet of documents. When you get to the third page, attachment number one, this is a letter dated January 29th, 2002 from the original architect that we worked with as we started planning for this project back in 1999.
Mr. Chair, I might as well get into this right away. Since we talked in my office, have you had the opportunity to talk to Mr. Ball?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, we met yesterday. We had an appointment with Mr. Ball. He was not available, but we met with Chris Kautz, his deputy. So we did meet with her and with Bill Foster from the Facilities Division at DAS.
My problem with this, and just running ahead in the book, this is all the case for why we ought to do it. And I think for most of us, we got religion on this point. What I don't have religion on at all is the mechanics, the planning, the connectivity with what DAS is doing with respect to other buildings on the mall. The place where there's any kind of interaction with the constitutional officers in this building about where they're going to go. The planning for where, I'm looking at Ms. Boss, where Ledge Council goes, where LFO goes. It's all of that kind of logistical stuff that just seems to be completely not there. And I'd love to be disabused of that, but I just don't see... You and I talked in my office about to what degree has staff been involved, the guys that really are the legislative staff, whether they've had the opportunity to weigh into this, because there's a lot of email traffic that suggests that they haven't, or at least some key staff haven't. And so the case, I think, is clear, but it's the execution piece that I'm kind of vague about.
Senator Johnson's, comments here. We're talking about and looking at a lot of potential or proposed activity in the construction, remodeling, what have you, here at the state capitol. And... I am bothered that there is not or does not appear to be overall planning on this. We're kind of going in our direction here as far as the wings are concerned, and somebody else is talking about building a Taj Mahal across the street, and we've got... my own attitude, personal attitude, is I believe this is the citizens of the state's facility and building. I believe this is their capital, not ours. Those of us who sit here in the legislature, or those of us who are staff and have devoted our lives to being here. We are merely servants in this regard, and I believe they have a right to have something that they can feel proud of, that they can bring their friends to when they come to the state of Oregon to visit. But in addition to that, they have a right, and I think it's a very fundamental right, to feel confident that as we prepare to spend their tens of billions of dollars, that we have looked at the whole scheme of things, not just a part of the puzzle sort of thing. So we would be interested in how, where the interrelationships are there. How do we get, all of the people, what's the planning process that's going to be necessary? I'm advised there's supposed to be, I think, some kind of a planning group for the... And my apologies if I may, Senator, I don't know what the group is called now, but if there is such a group, if there isn't such a group, there should be. But given the biases that you are encountering, on the committee here, and I think from all of our positions, it's not an anti-doing this. It's a matter of doing it the way we feel would be the best way to do it, so that we look at the whole piece rather than just part of the pie.
Mr. Chair, let me give you some background on what we have done. As Senator Johnson has said, we did meet in her office a couple of weeks ago and talk about this. What has happened is that last year when the Facilities Committee of the Public Commission took action on this proposal and approved it going to the full commission, at that time, I believe it was in September of 2006, we sat down with the chiefs of staff to the Secretary of State, the Treasurer, and the Governor, and informed them at that time that there was a possibility that we would be not extending the lease arrangements that we have with each of those offices. Prior to that meeting taking place, we looked at all of the space in the Capitol and the needs that the legislative branch would have in the event that we were to proceed with the renovation project. It was clear that we didn't have space in the building to relocate all of the legislative staff if we were to leave the statewide office holders in the office space that they had. We made a decision internally and consulted with the legislative leadership at that time and said we believe it would be less disruptive to the legislature to have the legislative offices remain in the Capitol and move the statewide office holders out of the building. So at that time, we met with the statewide office holders, the chiefs of staff to each of those offices, told them that there was a possibility that their leases would not be renewed. We require a 90-day notice if we're not going to renew those leases. We told them that at that time, we were not certain. We knew that funding for the project would probably come late in the session, and we couldn't give them any definitive guidance at that time. And as I said, that was September of last year. Toward the end of the year, when the full public commission met and discussed the renovation project, Bill Foster happened to be observing that on the closed circuit TV system. He immediately contacted us, and we met with him in, it was either November or December of last year, and had a discussion with him because he said this could fit in nicely with the planning that they are doing for the other building on the mall.
Senator Johnson.
You just made my point. Bill Foster shouldn't have to be serendipitously watching a TV screen to have a discussion about this building and how it fits into the mall activities. I mean, I'm just incredulous that that would be how DAS teed up to know what was going on. And the lights went on and everybody said, oh, by the way, maybe we ought to talk.
Point taken, I think.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So at that point, we started that discussion, and we really had no further discussion with him at that time. Following my meeting with Senator Johnson, we set up a meeting with Mr. Ball, and we had that meeting yesterday to reiterate the point that it appeared that we may be moving forward with this project. They have subsequently identified space in other buildings on the mall that is a possibility for moving those offices into. There has been a draft memo that has been prepared to go to the statewide office holders informing them that their leases would not be renewed, but at this point we have not proceeded with delivering that memo to them. I apologize to Senator Johnson that this has not been on the timeline that she would expect it to be on. I'm sorry for that.
Mr. Chair, I just feel compelled to respond. It's not on a timeline. It's just the seeming failure to communicate. I guess that just notifying the constitutional officers your lease is up, it just seems to me to lack a coordination. I haven't understood how this has moved with so little conversation.
Sitting here, Senator, fantasizing a little bit about, you know, considering all of the politics of this type of thing, how, you know, what a great rewarding experience it would be to participate in telling the governor, sorry, you're no longer here. You know, we're going to be nice to you. We can give you, you know, 90 days to get out.
It goes back to the underlying premise that I think we all share, and that is this is a venerable building, and there are parts of it that are old and tired and perhaps dangerous. I was in the governor's office the other day trying to attend a meeting, and those radiators chugging and moaning, and it's almost impossible to pay attention to what's going on in the meeting. our capital looks shabby compared to others. So the case for doing it, I think, is apparent. It's just all...
Representative, we have a call of the House.
All right, we are coming.
Yes. This is Rick Richardson has moved to pull House Bill 3545 from Ways and Means. This is funding the state police.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Oh, well, you guys have been going all day. Have a nice day.
Can I have a comment with you guys about what's called a procedural vote? Or otherwise, you're going to be here till Christmas. Okay.
Let me continue the meeting here, and Senator Johnson will keep me abreast of what's going on.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. Yeah, they're sending
Lisa
out.
Will,
they're hunting for you right now.
Thank you.
Bye, guys.
We shall return.
Your worst nightmare. I know.
Not at all, Senator Johnson. Not at all. I would like to go back and address a point that you made about staff involvement in this process. When this started many years ago, we had to make a decision. Actually, the legislative leaders had to make a decision as to how broadly we were going to involve, for instance, personal staff to the individual legislators. The feeling at that time was that the caucus offices, the presiding officers, and the chief clerk and the secretary should speak for the individual members and the staff, because to involve 90 legislators and upwards of 180 staff people in the process would have been somewhat difficult.
I completely agree that that would be impossibly cumbersome. But I'd like the reassurance that at some point there was a convocation of the staff, and at least their concerns were gathered and grabbed someplace. Some of the professional staff in this building are the guys that make it work, and they might have very salient observations about proximity of meeting rooms, ease of operation in some parts of just the mechanics of moving people and information around. I just think to ignore the input of longtime staff in the building ignores a resource. I certainly am not making a brief that there be 180 people at the table all deciding which shade of blue the cubicles ought to be, but nobody's demonstrated to me that anybody even said to the full-time staff in here, what do you think about this?
Madam Chair, on the contrary, there were representatives of the fiscal office, the revenue office, legislative council. All of the offices in the building have been involved in the planning process as we were drawing up plans.
I'm happy to be corrected.
We have subsequently had some discussions with some of the longtime personal staff. And we are right now, as a matter of fact, we've done some rework on some of the planning, addressing the concerns that have been raised, particularly about the Senate wing, where the offices right now are considerably larger than the offices on the House side, at least the staff space, I should say. And under the original redraw of the Senate, the staff space for the senators dropped down to the same size as the staff space for the House. A number of concerns were raised about that, so we've gone back and reworked those plans, and actually the average square footage now on the Senate side, with a rough drawing that came from the architect just last week, has gone from just under 150 square feet to 250 square feet for the Senate offices. I did run that by one of the longtime personal staff members who said it was a move in the right direction. Clearly, there are going to be some people on the Senate side who lose space for staff in this process, but with this change, we believe that it would still equitably distribute what space there is and leave the staff with more space than was originally envisioned under the plan that is in your binder. So the Senate drawing that is in your binder is in all likelihood not going to move forward because of the number of concerns that have been expressed. We believe the drawing for the House side is pretty much the way the House would come together. Under the current schedule, what we would hope to do would be after sine die, about 2 weeks after sine die, start to move the House offices out of the House wing and actually start construction on the House side in August of this year.
I'm going to stop you, Senator Bates.
I'm going to ask for a thoughtful pause here for a few minutes, Dave, and I've sort of followed this from one step away since 1999, and I'm well aware of the needs of change here from electrical and plumbing and all the rest of it, but I'm really concerned about the lack of vision. We really diminish future legislatures, and we diminish ourselves by walking into a building where people are cubbyholed as senators and representatives. It's actually embarrassing. When people come from other parts of the state and come to my office or come to offices around me, they're all surprised what the place looks like, how small the offices are for representatives and senators, how squeezed in the staff is. It's shabby, and it shows a lack of vision. And I worry about the entire planning process we're going through of moving people in and out of this building and whether they're going to go across the mall or whether or not. We had the treasurer earlier in the session talking about what he thought needed to be done for his staff to make it work, freeing up space in this building. Did not hear that from the Secretary of State. But there's a real lack of vision in this whole process. And yet there's a sense of urgency to get something done before we burn the building down again. There's that also. And I think you're trying to push forward on something this summer that you clearly did not have consensus for in this building. I know that the staff of the senators, for the most part, and this may change with the new plan, feel that what they're seeing on paper is completely inadequate, and they felt completely shut out of it. And even though some of them are only here for two or three sessions, I think they have some pretty good insights. They have to work every single day under those conditions. And I think that we need to take a deep breath here and think it through. You guys have put a huge amount of effort into it for the last 2 years. You're probably fearful in the back of your minds that the money will never be there if it isn't there now. And yet, I think it's time for a deep pause. This whole thing seems to be just sort of higgly-piggly, people moving back and forth and confused. This is something that may well set the course of what this building looks like for like 50 years or longer. And I just don't see that a consensus has been reached on it. I'm very concerned about that. And I'll look at the plans again when you updated them. But even if those plans appear to be appropriate, I have the same concerns as Senator Johnson does. And they go beyond just the plans for the wings. They go out to the entire facility here in Salem. You know, the kind of vision we're showing here would never have gotten these wings or this building built. I think that after it burned down in the 1930s, we'd probably be all in temporary huts right now if we were thinking the way we are now. We got to think past that. We got to think big, have some vision, and decide where we really want to go with this. And I know you put a huge amount of effort, and I appreciate that. I think you've been constrained by people saying, can't do it, can't do it, can't do it, it's too much money, and we got to think long-term here. We got to think 50 years out. Thank you, Chair.
Chair Johnson, Senator Bates, just to address your point, we would be, that's a policy decision that the Legislative Assembly has to make. And if the direction is that we should go back and rethink this, that's what we'll do. There are members who are concerned and have expressed this publicly that if we don't do it now, are we 2, 4, 6 years down the road? Since we didn't do it in 2002 as we had originally planned, or actually following the 2003 session, the project has been delayed. If it's delayed again, we'll go back to the drawing board and address the concerns that you've raised. If the direction is to move forward now, we'll work with you to the greatest extent possible to have it reflect the concerns that have been raised.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay.
As I was saying, the timeline is such that the house would be finished. I believe everything would be finished by about June of 2008. We would actually move the Senate out starting in November of 2007. And as a point that Senator Johnson raised when we met a couple of weeks ago, this does entail legislators not having private offices for that period of time. The question has been raised about where they could work. We've really got three options that we've put on the table. Option one is, obviously your floor desk would be a place where you could work, and we could put wireless hubs in the chambers so that you could access the wireless system from the chambers. The second option is that we would envision relocating the caucus offices, and in those relocations put a number of cubicles there that would include telephone and PCs for members to use on a first-come, first-served basis. The other option, which is not very attractive but is certainly something that we could look into, is to put portables somewhere on the grounds and put cubicles in those portables that would be a space for legislators to work in lieu of having private offices. But it will be disruptive. I don't want to mislead you at all.
In your conversation yesterday with DAS, what's their planning horizon for looking at a new mall building? I mean, they're now planning, I think, out 2 years. Given the resistance that you're seeing in this committee, I guess I'm looking for what's Plan B. I'm not sure the Wings make it out of this committee. I mean, you've got three senators here that comprise the committee. I don't think you have one of us at this stage in development. So I guess my question to you is, instead of talking about something that appears to not have legs, what's Plan B?
Madam Chair, Plan B is that we would hope there would be a budget note or a vehicle by which a group consisting of the legislative branch, the executive branch, and probably the judicial branch would be assembled following session to have those long-term discussions for space on the mall. And we've had that discussion with Mr. Foster when we met with him last year. We said, if we don't proceed, the best thing we can do is have all of us get together at the table after session and do some planning so that when we come back in 09, we're better prepared to present a plan to you that would meet your concerns.
Because I think what might be useful at this juncture is to have the plan to plan. And because I don't see, unless the Senate president rushes in here and figures out which one of us he's going to roll, I just don't see this moving forward at this point. And knowing that you're at least thinking about who do we convene, who's appropriate to this conversation, might be useful. The case is clear of why we need to do it. Just look at this room. But the mechanics just aren't there. Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, we're going to be back in February. We're not going to be back in January of 09. We're going to be back in February of 08. This should be, I think, priority one in February of 08. And I think you gain a lot of credence and you gain a lot of support if you had more people involved in the planning from the grassroots here, some staffers that work every day in those offices. Most of the senators, I don't think, have seen this at all. They kind of know something's going on. I think they're thinking more like the curtains are going to be changed or getting new carpeting, and they don't understand, as I don't understand, all the things that have to change to make these wings really work. I mean, we have to open up maybe the fourth floor for senators and move those people off the fourth floor somewhere else. Maybe not. Those are the kind of decisions that have to be made. Does LC really have the room they need? Does LFO have the room they need? And do they have the room they're going to need in the future? You know, this state's going to grow. We're going to have a couple more million people here in 50 years. The state legislature will probably, I think, moving to nearly full-time in the next 10 or 15 years. It's that complex of issues we're dealing with, and the budget's that big now. Are we set up to have a year-round legislature sitting here as they do in other states around us? I mean, things are going to really change. Are the Secretary of State, are the Treasurer appropriate to be in this building, to be somewhere else? Should the governor be somewhere else? These are really big questions and really germane to what you're trying to do. You know, and I appreciate what you're trying to do, but we don't just want to remodel. We want to redesign, I think. And we got to think about where we're going to be in 2050. not right today or 5 years from now or 6 or 7 years from now?
Chair Johnson, Senator Bates, you're absolutely right about the space needs in the building. Council clearly needs more space, and we do have a plan B for that. The prospect of having Senate offices built on the fourth floor has been raised, and we've had preliminary discussions about what that would entail, and it is certainly something that, in fact, we have had an initial discussion with the architect to say, what would it look like if we had three floors of Senate offices instead of two? We've not had them proceed withdrawing that because we didn't want to spend the money if that wasn't going anywhere. If that is the direction that comes out of this committee or out of this legislature, we would be, we would start meeting immediately, and we would work to have a detailed plan, a comprehensive plan, available for consideration in the February special session.
Mr. Henderson, I don't think any of us want to tell you how to do the plan, whether the offices are 250 square feet or 255 square feet. I don't think that's the intent of the legislature, nor frankly should it be. But I think we're looking for a plan that's almost like a military campaign. These guys move here. This happens here. This is where the... There seems to just be this kind of amorphous, and we're waiting for the legislatures to give us guidance. We shouldn't be telling you where the chairs ought to go, but we should be able to, at this juncture, to talk about making a $31 million investment. I ought to be able to describe the plan to somebody, and I can't. And I just don't feel very confident moving ahead with a $31 million program that I couldn't explain. And I would dare say that Senator Whitsitt and Senator Bates couldn't tell me what they think the plan is. That's the problem. On this point, I think we've all made our points back and forth. I'm not sure how much more we can do at this juncture. We have been joined by a distinguished person who's going to testify, the Attorney General. And so I think what I'm going to do is to end this portion of the discussion right here, move into the Legislative Council overview. And I think the Law Commission, I'm going to turn to the professional staff. Ms. McHugh, we want to start with the testimony for the Law Commission. Okay. And, well,
yes, sir.
Mr. Chair.
We have returned.
Was the bill sent back to committee? Or
what happened?
What happened? Was the bill sent back to committee?
Oh, the bill failed.
Oh.
That's
retro. Kind of a surprise. We didn't expect those sort of things to happen like that, you know.
Like the loser looks out on me, so.
Mr. Chair, with your permission, what we had done was to just conclude pounding on the wings and moved into the Law Commission. We've been joined by the Attorney General, and I think Mr. Shetterly is somewhere out in the hallway waiting to be called to testify on the Law Commission.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I assume that you got everything you were hoping for.
That would be an incorrect assumption.
Oh, okay. Okay. And then with that, we're moving on to hearing the Legislative Council portion of the budget. And we do have Ann Boss here, and we have some other folks here to testify on this, including the Honorable Hardy Myers. And would we like to start out, Mr. Myers, with your presentation? You want assistance? I'd never,
the
never
formerly seen honorable.
The once honorable.
No one lawyer will ever suffice for anything. So, let's bring two to the table.
Thank
and
you.
Proceed on. Ed, whoever at your pleasure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lane Shetterly. Today, before you, in my capacity as chair of the Oregon Law Commission, with me is Hardy Myers. And Mr. Chair, I'm not appearing before you today as lawyer, but as client. Hardy is my lawyer these days, and so I'm here with legal counsel. And actually, the good news, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is that I am here with you in this hearing room and not in the next hearing room, which simultaneously is hearing the Measure 37 bills. So you you take your pick, but if I were you, I'd rather be here, probably.
Mr. Shetterly, have a little stumbling over titles
yes.
at this point. But the chair has made it a long-standing position to avoid, like the plague, anything that has anything to do with Measure 37.
Mr. Chair, I am pleased to accommodate your preference this morning. For these moments, anyway.
Yes. All right.
Briefly, and I will be brief because I'm also out in the hall and down in the other hearing room. I am here before you as chair of the Oregon Law Commission to testify in support of the appropriation and the policy option package for the Law Commission. The Law Commission was established by the legislature in 1997 to engage in a continuous program of law reform and law improvement, and was created really as a wholly volunteer organization for the first biennium. We were very fortunate with the support of the legislature following the 1999 Legislative Assembly to seek a partnership with Oregon's law schools, and we were able to engage after a competitive bidding process with Willamette University, which now serves as our private sector partner with the Law Commission. So this truly is an example of public and private partnership in terms of how state dollars are leveraged with private investment and private support through Willamette University, particularly in the law school. The commission's current services appropriation, just over $200,000 a biennium, is before you, as well as the policy option package that would continue present staff attorney position for the law commission. As I mentioned, the partnership we have with Willamette University, going back to 2000, provides the office and substantial staff support for the Law Commission. It's augmented by legislative counsel, which is why the state funding for the Law Commission has historically been processed through the legislative counsel budget. The agreement under which the state has worked with Willamette over the years has been that Willamette would match the state contribution to the commission. As you can imagine, Willamette's contribution is something more now than the state's contribution. The state's contribution to the commission has remained relatively flat for the years that we have been funding the commission at the state level. Certainly, the overhead and other costs related to the commission have increased, and Willamette has borne substantially. It's more than its share of that increase. And so we are here today to request your continuing support and contribution at the state level for maintenance of the commission work. You see the commission's work every biennium, every session, in terms of the bills that the commission comes forward with. This is not low-hanging fruit. Some of the work that the commission does is very complicated. And the commission does it through largely volunteer efforts of lawyers, judges, law professors, and other people that we bring in to support the work of the commission. Currently, there are over 250 volunteers engaged in support of the work that the Law Commission does. Obviously, though, full-time staff is required to maintain continuity, to provide support for the commission during the legislative sessions, and to manage the work of those 250 volunteers. As an example of one that I think demonstrates the value of the commission's work to the legislature is a bill going through this session amending Oregon's government borrowings statutes. We have an arcane and archaic system of statutes relative to bonding and borrowing at the state level, at the local level, and statutes that appear to combine elements of both. We took it upon the commission at the request of the Metropolitan Debt Advisory Commission to amend Oregon's government borrowing statutes. That bill is currently in the Revenue Committee. We've estimated that the time spent by volunteers in that goes into the six figures over the past 2 years. The hours upon hours that have been spent in amending those statutes to bring them to the legislature for enactment in this session. We'll continue to do that on behalf of the commission. There is a great partnership here, not only between the state and Willamette University, but also the leveraging that we get out of the volunteer work through the base of support that Willamette and the state bring to the commission. That really concludes my testimony. I do thank you for your time and attention and interest this morning, and urge your support for the continued funding for the Law Commission.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shetterly, you had talked about the public-private partnership between the Law Commission and the Law School. The first time that I had the opportunity to hear this budget request for the Law Commission, I was surprised that the other two law schools, and frankly embarrassed because one of them is my alma mater.
Mine too.
Didn't participate as fully as Willamette. Has there been any attempt to reach out to either the university or to Lewis and Clark and gauge their interest? I don't know whether or not, I'm sure Willamette would like the financial relief. I would also assume that the special relationship between the legislature and Willamette is something that they prize. But I just, particularly now, I'm on the Board of Visitors of Northwestern, and I'm just trying to figure out, is there a way that we could broaden, enrich that public-private partnership by having the other two law schools participate? Maybe they provide lawyers. I don't know.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, just to go back in history, the original process by which the commission came to be housed for administrative services at Willamette Law School was an invitation request to submit bids. Willamette and University of Oregon did. Lewis and Clark, our alma mater, chose not to at that time. By the same token, though, that's only a piece of it. Bernie Vail is a representative from Lewis and Clark to the commission, very active, and has chaired work groups. And we also do get volunteer services from other Lewis and Clark law faculty. Same thing from the University of Oregon. Dom Vetri is the designee from the University of Oregon to the Law Commission. He's very involved. And so the other two law schools have embraced the work of the commission through the support of their faculty. And, in fact, we meet at those schools. They provide us with meeting space periodically. So there's a good presence, I think, of both schools on the commission, and we make an effort to involve both when we can.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Saturday?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I may be excused, then I'll go see what's happening in the hall.
Okay.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. Members, for the record, I'm Hardy Myers, Attorney General, and I'm here this morning as a member of the Oregon Law Commission. The Attorney General of Oregon is an ex officio member by statute, and
The Republican contingency on this committee are going to take a momentary recess, and we are going to go to the floor again for a call.
Just the R's or the D's?
Yeah, I want my Democratic colleagues to call me.
We will pass the gavel on down, and Mr. Meyer, we will continue the hearing.
Mr. Chair,
some people have all the luck.
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Bye, guys.
You want us to continue, Mr. Chair?
Let's hold a moment in recess, just for a second.
You should get right back now.
Does Mr. Kanegi and Ms. Johnson want to come up together, or do you want to testify separately? Your preference. Good afternoon.
Hey.
Or good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Dave Kanagi. I serve as Associate Dean at the Willamette University College of Law and also as Executive Director of our Oregon Law Commission. I want to make sure you all know Wendy Johnson, our Deputy Director, who is actively walking the halls and pressing forward with the many legislative proposals that have come from the Commission this time around. Obviously, it goes without saying, I speak in support of the budget proposal, not only renewal of what has been our funding, but the option package as well. That having been said, I wish to just make one point about the Oregon Law Commission's work that may have escaped attention, but is worthy of just a moment of reflection. And it has to do with the nature of the legislative process in just a very simple way. The phrase has been used, nonpartisan advancement of legislation, but the work of the Law Commission goes one step further. It engages in the process during the interim of assembling work projects for presentation to the legislature that are under the heading of disinterested law reform. Now, that sounds like uninterested, and it is often uninteresting. I stress that. As Max Williams, who served as a commissioner, used to put it, I don't expect to get reelected on the basis of anything that I've done for the Oregon Law Commission. However, his passion for its work was enormous, and that is because of how we do our work. Rather than assemble interested parties and invite them to bring their representational capacities to the table. When one serves on a work group of the Oregon Law Commission, we expressly advise those who are joining us on work groups to check their representational interests at the door and bring their expertise only. Therefore, it is more than nonpartisan, it is disinterested. That is, we try to scrub the interest group elements of thinking about law reform from the process and invite expertise so that law professors, practitioners, judges, administrative heads, and agency personnel bring who they are, but bring what they've learned to the table.
Then let me ask you this, having sat through what seemed like interminable meetings of the Law Commission in the interim, dealing with a uniquely politically suffused issue, ethics reform, do you take all comers? The thing that concerned me last time was that it almost seemed as though the Law Commission, I don't mean this as a criticism, just an observation, it seemed as though the Law Commission took on something that was uniquely political to chase the money. And my concern is that if you begin taking on those kinds of activities, when do you lose your ability to become that neutral forum to talk about bond, some of this stuff that is just about as interesting as eating a Presto log.
This stuff.
but I mean, you seems to lurch back and forth between the very, very esoteric cleaning up of the statutes and being on point on ethics. Supercharged politically. And I'm just trying to figure out, how do you use a filter to say, this really might not be an issue area that we would like the legislature to punt to the Law Commission?
Well, very good question. The answer, I think, is this, or the response works this way. Obviously, Attorney General Myers chaired the Ethics Project and can respond further on this. But
and what I really meant to say, those were scintillating, intellectually stimulating,
yes, wonderful meetings.
Riveting meetings. That's what I meant to say.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Thank you. First of all, the history on that particular project was that it was at the request of the governor that the Oregon Law Commission took it on after a veto in the 2001 session. And so we were invited to take it on. It then goes to, however, we don't just do it because if we were asked, it actually went through our program committee, also chaired by the Attorney General, where we grapple with that very issue you've raised, the issue of how do we maintain who we are, nonpartisan and apolitical, and yet take on what inevitably will be a supercharged political project? And the answer was, and is, I think, consistently, that when we formed the work group for this particular project, that is the Ethics Reform Project, we had categories of those who we asked to be included, including members. Members were the only ones who voted, and they were asked specifically to check their representational interests. Bring only your expertise. And then include everyone else we can as advisors, and again, gather those who must be around the table so that as the political process begins in the legislature, we have at least teed up what thoughtful people believe to be the best answers to the problems. And then, again, the Law Commission's authority is always limited to simply recommending. Those recommendations then enter the political process, at which time, here before the Oregon Legislature, the lightning bolts of attention that are necessary to move the bill forward must necessarily be brought to bear. It seems to me, Senator Johnson, the key answer to how we maintain that firewall between lapsing into just a political toady for someone and the thoughtful, expertise-driven, disinterested law reform entity that we believe ourselves to be is ever-present vigilance on precisely the issue raised. And we accomplish that, I believe, through a very careful and methodical program committee that screens each project that we're invited to take on.
I think that's a great answer, and I would just respond by saying, having sat through all those scintillating meetings under the gavel of the Attorney General, seeing so much of the work product get ignored in this building has been very disappointing. I don't ask you to respond. I just make that editorial comment.
Thank you. And before turning it then to Deputy Director Johnson for some overviews of what we have done and what we intend to do in the next session, I'd like to end with just one simple metaphor and let it sit. Just as the legislature funds in transportation, roads, highways, and bridges, it's understood that over time, roads, highways, and bridges need repair, attention, resurfacing, and rebuilding. Incredibly, though the black letter law, when placed, and there they are, in the ORS, seem fixed and static, circumstances around those laws change, and just as those actions of the legislature that fund necessary activities in the state require themselves further attention as time goes by, so too the laws, the black letter law of the Oregon legislature. And that's where the Law Commission, again, coming at it from a place that is not driven by private money interest, can take a look for you and tee up, we hope, at least the best ideas we can offer you based on an awful lot of hard work with footprints shown in the form of reports and all that goes with it. So I hope that metaphor is at least one way of thinking about the work that we do. With that overextension,
I would just caution you to take a good hard look at the investment we're making in our transportation system before you use that metaphor again. The three of us come from rural places where our roads are turning to gravel. Bad analogy. Ms. Johnson.
Thank you, Vice Chair Johnson, members of the committee. I have two handouts that I'd like to submit to you before I get too far along here.
What's going on upstairs?
Vincent is carrying the bill right now. My name is Wendy Johnson. I'm Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission, for the record. What I'm having Teresa McHugh pass out is a letter in support of the Law Commission's budget, and also just a visual graph of the number of bills the Law Commission has recommended to this body since the Commission's creation in 1997 and then its first bills in 1999. The letter and the graph, I think, will help demonstrate to you the need and how the Law Commission has really changed since the Commission's creation. I just want to make three main points. There is a need for our current services level appropriation and our option package. The quality and the quantity of the Commission's work since its creation has just grown pretty much astronomically, from four bills in the 1999 session to over 22 bills this session. and they're complex bills, and they take a lot of work, both in the interim and during the session. And frankly, the Law Commission has been relied on by your colleagues in both the House and the Senate, and some of the members in this committee have really seen our work. The letter that you have before you is primarily signed by members in the Judiciary Committee, because that has been our traditional home, because we're doing law reform that affects the general area of law that would be in the Judiciary Committee. But you will see Representative Barnhart's signature there. He chairs the Revenue Committee and has that bond bill in his committee. You'll see past and present Judiciary Committee members and some other folks that we've worked with over the years. But we thought our budget was hearing was going to be tomorrow, so we haven't had a lot of time to get more folks to sign on to support. But I think the letter does provide to you an example of why the Law Commission is so loved, is that you'll see both sides of the aisle that are supporting the commission, because we've become relied upon to provide a policy bill that is up front and telling you what the problem is in the law and how the Law Commission suggests fixing it. But we also note quite right up front of what the other choices would be and where there is dissension. We don't hide the ball. We are created by the Legislative Assembly to assist you, and we do that as best we can. So I would like you to keep that in mind. Chair Jensen, now that your committee is assembled back, perhaps it would be best to go back to the Attorney General before
I think that probably that would be fine. We can go back. I assume Senator Page will be right back.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Once again, good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Again, for the record, Hardy Myers, Attorney General, and have a chance to comment briefly on the Law Commission's budget and option package. As I was mentioning in my earlier testimony, the Attorney General is an ex officio member of the Law Commission, and as also mentioned previously, I chaired the Government Ethics Review Project that began in the fall of 2005 during this biennium. I'm also chair of the Commission's Program Committee, which facilitates the selection of projects for the commissioners. It is, in effect, the gatekeeper for the Commission. I've seen the quality and the quantity of proposals for law reform work submitted to the Commission steadily grow through the last several years, and I think the graph that Wendy has distributed, which shows you the number of Commission measures that have been introduced, also show the dramatic increase in the actual output of the Commission that's going to the legislature for its consideration. But the fact is, there's a continuing need for nonpartisan quality law reform in complex areas of law. And I think that the law reform community, so to speak, is coming to appreciate that and to rely increasingly on the Law Commission as the center of that work in Oregon. And recent proposals to the Commission have come from the Legislative Assembly, which included the Ethics Project, the state and local governments, the state treasurer, the governor, the bench, the bar, and other sources. And many of our projects can't be conducted by just any one stakeholder, and we need the input in many instances of, for example, state and local government and the private sector. I'd also like to add that the Department of Justice, for its part, has strongly supported and participated in the work of the Law Commission, because the state agencies often are the beneficiaries of the clarifications of law, the updating of law that results from the Commission's work. And examples of the Department of Justice-involved projects have included the Ethics Project, family law, various family law projects, various juvenile law-related projects. And I'm very proud to have aligned the department very closely with the work of the commission, at least during my tenure. I would just like to conclude, Mr. Chair and members, by very, very strongly adding my word of support to the policy option package which the subcommittee has, which would, for about $150,000 for the coming biennium, permit us to maintain the staff attorney position that was added to the commission staff before this biennium began, or at the beginning of this biennium. That position has been immensely helpful to the Commission. It was devoted for this past biennium to the Ethics Project, but the need for that additional lawyering capability, staff lawyering capability, is really quite large, and I respectfully hope that the subcommittee will ultimately conclude that that policy option package should be approved to continue that additional resource for the Commission. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Question for the Attorney General?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was teasing a little bit earlier. I feel compelled to add my comments to those of the Attorney General. The Law Commission took on the extremely complicated task of trying to wrestle with ethics reform for the legislature, and as the Attorney General pointed out, at the request of the governor. These were rigorous meetings that generated an enormous work product. Just the paper alone was huge. Keeping track of it in the thoughtful, comprehensive way that the Law Commission did was really almost a juggling feat, to have the preparatory materials arrive before the meeting so that people were ready to jump into the work when we convened. It was an extraordinary project, and I just feel compelled to compliment both the chair and the staff on the record for the work that they did. It was a series of long, complicated meetings that I think had a wide variety of stakeholders at the table, and I just want to commend Ms. Johnson and Mr. Kanegi, Dean Kanegi, and their staffs for the work product that they turned out. Again, I'm sorry that the legislature didn't undertake more of it to move it through the process, but it was extraordinary to be part of a Law Commission initiative looking at this complicated issue.
Mr. Chair, might I add briefly, I would like to also return the compliment and thank Senator Johnson for her participation in the project. She was not just a nominal member. She was extremely active and diligent in her participation, as was Representative Berger from the House side of the Assembly. And both Senator Johnson and Representative Berger brought important perspectives to the work of the project, and I think made significant contributions to the decision-making as it went along. And I might add, too, very briefly, if I may, that, Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I really think that by the time the Legislative Assembly, the session has ended, I believe that all of the actual proposals of the Commission will have at least been considered, and I think some number of them will ultimately be acted on. Senate Bill 10 is going to be the receptacle for a number of proposals, but I think that when that measure reaches the House, the proposals of the Commission that address subjects in a different way that are in Senate Bill 10 will be considered, looked at by the House Committee, and assessed.
One of the ones that I hope receives some consideration on the House side is the question of passing through. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay. Apparently. Please, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Jensen, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. I want to talk to you about a couple of things with this option package and our current services level. As I was saying before, I provided you with the visual chart of our bills, and then behind that are a list of the bills this session and those bills that were submitted to the Assembly in each session prior. You'll see the quantity and also the quality of the legislation we've been recommending has been steadily increasing. There is a need for this level because of the number of requests we're getting. We're turning down projects. In the letter that I've provided to you that is signed by members of the Assembly, lists some of the projects that we had to turn down and that we already have teed up for next session. Child abuse reporting reform, for example, background checks, our continued work in the area of juvenile law and family law is listed. I understand, just walking through the hall yesterday, one of the members of the Senate let us know that there's a problem in another area of law regarding malpractice that may end up going to the Law Commission as well. And I just want to make the point that the members of the Assembly look to the Law Commission when something isn't going well in committee because there's so many interested parties and it's complex that we are looked at as a place to to draw the resources, to provide the resources, to bring in expertise and work through an issue and come back the next session with a recommendation. So there is a need. We're turning down projects, and you've come to rely on us to fix those complex areas. Second, there's value for the appropriation. Willamette has matched the contributions that the state provides, and we are able to leverage such work group member volunteers support. 250 lawyers, they're not all lawyers, but most of them are. 250 volunteers are volunteering to assist us. That if the state had to pay for that, would come at a really expensive price tag that we're just able to leverage because they're willing to get involved with our projects in the interim. And that comes to you free because of the way we are able to, as a staff and commission, utilize those resources. Also the value of our commissioners' time. You'll see on our letterhead who our commissioners are. Perhaps we should have started there. Our commission is composed of members appointed by the Senate, appointed by the House, the governor's office. The Attorney General serves as ex officio, the Chief Justice. Three members are appointed by the Bar, Board of Governors, and then each of Oregon's three law schools. So we have quite the esteemed list of folks who serve as commissioners because of the statute that the Assembly created to establish the commission, and those commissioners all serve as volunteers. So you're getting that leverage for your appropriation as well. So I've expressed the need, the value, and finally the savings to both private and public individuals and entities by the Law Commission's work that's funded by your appropriation. There's been court efficiency improved, litigation savings because we're repealing statutes that are unconstitutional or outdated or confusing, attorney time with clearer laws, and also that our citizenry can actually pick up a statute and understand it. We're improving. We're just cutting costs there. Also, we'd like to think that we're assisting legislative counsel because we fix big areas of law often that those, if you had to amend those bills during session, it's difficult because the statutes are so bungled to begin with. So if you're starting with something, it's a lot easier to amend. And so we're working with legislative counsel in the interim to do the work that we do. And finally, individual bills provide cost savings. For example, the child support bill from last session. We have child support orders that are entered at an administrative process and child support orders that are entered at a judicial process. They were never speaking to each other, and so parties, including the state, were litigating those child support amounts twice. And now we have a process in statute that says which order will prevail and how to reconcile those. That's a cost savings of attorney time and state attorney time and DA time and administrative time. We're literally saving money with the recommendations, some of the recommendations that we provide. Finally, I want to close with just the numbers. The Law Commission has been appropriated about $100,000 a year, and what you're getting for that is a part-time executive director, a full-time deputy director, that's myself, as a lawyer, and then a part-time administrative assistant. It's all the photocopying, all the housing, conference spaces, and all the work that we produce. That's what you're getting for your $100,000 appropriation, and we're asking to add an additional staff attorney to assist us in that work. That's the bottom line of what we're asking for. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Representative Galizia.
Ms. Johnson, and I'm sorry, maybe I missed some of this, but you said that Willamette University matches the contributions that the state makes. And then I know Senator Johnson was asking about Lewis and Clark and other law schools. Are any other law schools involved to the extent where they're making any kind of contributions currently?
Chair Jensen, Representative Galizia, the way the Law Commission is staffed is our offices are at Willamette University, and Willamette is paying for the photocopy machine, the fax machines, the computers. They had the office expenses, and that's the staff. The commission itself is 13 members, and Lewis and Clark and University of Oregon and Willamette University all have a commissioner who serves on the commission, and so their contribution is that way by their having their commissioner serve as a volunteer. Then we also look to all three law schools on given projects for experts. For example, the University of Oregon, Leslie Harris works as a reporter on a paternity project this session for the Judiciary Committee, or that ended up in the Judiciary Committee, and she volunteered countless hours on that project. But there's not a dedicated funding stream coming from Lewis and Clark or University of Oregon to pay for the general day-to-day staffing or office expenses.
So
When you say Willamette matches the contributions that the state makes, you're talking about in terms of sort of personnel, and that's what you're saying. You're not saying it's not a strictly financial match money.
Chair Jensen, Representative Galizia, correct. It's often in kind,
okay,
or other benefits and staffing. Yes.
One more question?
But of course.
It's pretty expensive to go to, for example, Willamette University Law School in Lewis and Clark, and I imagine the prestige and credibility to be aligned with the Law Commission is quite useful from the perspective of these law schools. So would it be problematic, and in what some way I'm not thinking about, for them to make contributions, financial contributions, not just sort of in kind?
Chair Jensen, Representative Galizia, you're thinking it's problematic to provide.
No, I'm asking you why wouldn't Willamette gladly pony up $75,000, or Lewis and Clark as kind of a buy-in, because this is prestigious and useful from their perspective. So instead of having the state pony up all the money, why not? I guess that's what I'm asking you about. Can't imagine I'm the first person to even broach this.
Chair Jensen, Representative Galizia, I think that's a question that's, you know, better reserved to the president or the dean of the law school. And there is obviously a benefit to the university to house this commission. But the question is how much of a benefit when all the work that is done is in support of the state. I mean, there's not a bill that assists Willamette University, for example. It's all legislation to assist the state in its processes. And at some point, you know, whether the benefit is there strong enough. And it's really the partnership was intended to be a partnership, and now we're at the point where the partnership is out of skew, and we're asking to truly make the state an equal partner.
Do we have to call the House?
We have another call of the House. We're going to recess momentarily until Senator Bates and Senator Johnson return, or until House members return. We'll stand in recess.
I think probably Thursday is what I'm going to suggest, and the reason that is because tomorrow we have assembly scheduled in Commission on Indian Services, and there are people who are planning to come and testify on behalf of Commission on Indian Services. So rather than put you through kind of sitting in between, I would suggest, Madam Chair, that we ask Legislative Council to return on Thursday.
Okay. I stick around, though. Okay. So we're going to come back in for the purpose of adjourning the... Let's start this again. Can you make that part go away? Because I wasn't... Okay. So, are you ready now? Okay. Okay, we have just come back into order for the purpose of adjourning the public hearing on Senate Bill 5522, the budget of legislative agencies. And for the record, we will be hearing Legislative Council on Thursday. We will be hearing the Commission on Indian Services on Wednesday and taking public testimony. And with that, the committee is adjourned for Monday, or for May the 1st, Tuesday, May the 1st.